The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in beautiful Philadelphia. Great day today. And we're streaming live on WWDBAM.com. You can join us on Boomer Generation Radio by going to our Facebook page and saying hello and clicking like or whatever you do on that thing. And you can get a hold of us also at BoomerGenerationRadio@gmail.com. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is being brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L. We invite you to visit www.discoverkendall.org or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. And we are very delighted to welcome to the station and to the microphone here at Boomer Generation Radio, Mr. Harry Platt, the manager of Platt Memorial Chapels in beautiful downtown Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
It's always sunny in Cherry Hill.
It's always put that on the flag. Yes. So, Harry, welcome. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming into the studio today, and welcome to Boomer Generation Radio.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad I got to the right studio. I almost walked into XTU this morning. Then I realized that there's no Jewish country star, so, you know.
There probably is somewhere, you know, hiding out.
What do you think about? You can't think about pickups
guilt.
And beer.
Guilt.
And,
yeah, it's guilt. You have that lament about guilt.
Okay.
And that would be a great country song, by the way. You know, something you should write that out.
Had a schnapps, got into my Lexus 4x4, you know. It's
right. You know, the dog ate
next?
My homework, and
I didn't get into grad school.
And the recipe for the matzo balls got lost. Something like that. And you know something? It would sell.
There you go.
It would sell.
We have a new market.
But back to your market. We want to spend some time today, and again, I thank you for coming in, to talk about an issue for our generation and parents and our families that's there for everyone, and sadly sometimes gets to the last minute in crisis. The whole idea of funerals and the planning of funerals, the trends of what's happening in the industry as a clergy person, and we talked about this a little bit before time.
Right.
There's a significant, some shifts in the industry and the way funerals are held and et cetera. So first of all, we spend a lot of time in congregation land across denominations, et cetera, now talking to families about not waiting to the last minute. What's the value from your perspective as the funeral director, as the manager of Platt Memorial Chapels, of having families do what we call pre-need?
Right. The biggest value in pre-need is that the toughest decisions that people often make at the worst times in their lives are already made. They have the ability really to think about them. And if they can't make a decision while they're doing the pre-need, they can always call me back in a week or 2 weeks and say, I've thought about this. This is what I'd like to do. So that when, God forbid, that moment comes, which sometimes people know it's coming if someone's on hospice or long-term illness, or sometimes it's sudden, people can pick up a phone, not have to make any difficult decisions except what time and what day would you like to have the service. And that's the extent of their decision-making at the worst time in their lives. So this takes away all those tough decisions at a difficult time.
Yeah, I've worked with families enough and always suggest that they do pre-need, and having experienced it not only in my own family but with other members of congregations, that it really, you could see the lessening of the tension, because when the moment comes, all they do is pick up the phone, they call you, and, you know, activate the file, and
Correct.
Everything else is taken care of.
Correct.
It's a huge stress reliever. Mm-hmm. Do you find people now being more open to that, or is there still some sense of, oh, if we do this now, it's sort of like the evil eye and some superstition?
There are some people who still have that feeling, and usually they come in closer to a time of need, mm-hmm. Than others. Most people now think of it as a planning mechanism. the same way you plan with life insurance and estate planning and everything else. People think about this as a end-of-life planning issue. So I find more people are doing this now based on that. And I find also they're coming in a little bit younger than they used to come in.
Really?
Probably in their late 60s, mid to late 60s, the early 70s. No health issues, no concerns, just, again, don't want to have their children or their spouse make any difficult decisions or have the kind of stress to plan a service at a difficult time.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who really like what you just said. I mean, coming in younger in their late 70s or, you know, that's nice.
And that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, yeah.
Look, and as people live longer, the realities, and I do maintain that, especially for baby boomers, we've seen a lot of what's happened with our parents' generation,
right,
and we don't want to repeat that for our own families, which I think is a very, very valuable tool. The laws, how different are the laws regarding funerals from state to state? Are there variations in that law, or is everything pretty much standardized?
A lot of it's standardized. There's once in a while. Most of the difference in laws are about pre-need,
uh-huh,
and how the money is trusted and how the money is put away. That's most of the differences in funeral law. A lot of the standard things are the same. There's a couple small variations here and there, but not what that will affect the general planning of the service, just where maybe some of the supplies come from. One example I'll bring up is a burial vault or outside burial container. Some people think these are mandated by state or federal law. They are not.
When you say outside burial, that's a concrete box?
That's a concrete box.
Right.
And I tell people when they think about this, when I make arrangements, I tell people to think of a shoebox. The bottom half of this shoebox is already in the ground before you get to the cemetery. You don't even see it. And then the casket's lowered into this, and then a top is placed on, like a shoebox,
mm-hmm,
before the rest of the earth is placed in. The cemeteries that require this are trying to prevent the graves from sinking down in the future, because eventually the weight of the earth on top of just a casket will make things sink down a little bit. So cemeteries will require this, and it's strictly a cemetery-by-cemetery decision.
Yeah.
New Jersey, for instance, the cemeteries are not permitted to provide these. In Pennsylvania, they are. So, again, it's not affecting the decision in whether you have to use it or not. It's just going to affect where it comes from. But the decision still has to be made for the family whether the cemetery will require this or not.
What's the story with embalming?
Embalming is not required by state or federal law either.
In every state?
In every state that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm aware of. Let me just preface by saying that.
No.
There are certain situations where a certain cemetery, especially in the case of using a mausoleum, may require embalming for that reason. So there are certain situations within cemeteries, within different choices a family makes for where their burial sites will be, where that may be required.
And there are religious issues and various religious traditions, correct?
Correct. Most of the Middle Eastern countries, Judaism, Muslims, they don't believe in embalming. They believe in the body returning to the earth as quickly as possible. So embalming is not required or not – is contrary to those two religious rules.
So, go ahead.
And I was saying a lot of people in a lot of religions that have viewings, mm-hmm, and longer term for funeral services, Catholics, for instance, where they may have a viewing for 2 or 3 days and an open casket, they would traditionally do embalming because they want to make sure that the person who passed away will look the best possible, for lack
correct
of a better term, for the viewing and funeral service.
You just alluded to the mausoleum thing. Have you seen I see more and more cemeteries erecting above-ground burial vaults,
right,
as opposed to the traditional in-ground. Is this one of the trends that seems to be coming?
It is one of the trends that seems to be coming. It's very interesting. There's a cemetery up in North Jersey who, the first time when they built the mausoleum, they advertised it as the most traditional Jewish burial. And they referred to Abraham putting Sarah
in the cave.
Correct.
Right.
So it was interesting how the marketing aspect took on a mausoleum. But most people are looking as mausoleums as an alternative now, a proper alternative for what they wish to have. Some people are just that's just their preference. Some people don't want to be buried in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, they have their own preference for that. And people are doing it more and more just as a trend that's happening in society now.
So talking about the trends and changes, I know as a clergy person, I over the 40-some years I've been, you know, since I was ordained, I've just noticed in doing and working with families changes. But
right,
you must be seeing in the context of your business, trends and changes representing a whole variety of different ideas. Could you just what have you seen in the, let's say, in the last 5 to 10 years?
The last 5 to 10 years, and I've been doing this since I was 13 years old. So for
I've been doing this for
36 years. So. one of the biggest things that I've seen trend wise is how the service is conducted. You know, and judging from a clergy point of view, that's what I see most, how the service is conducted. More people are deciding to speak, which is one of the most traditional things. Again, going back to Abraham and Sarah, that's one of the more traditional things, but more families are choosing to speak. And we try to tell families that when they're going to have speakers, to try to make sure a couple of things, and we talked about this prior to coming
this morning.
Try to make sure somebody has things written down, because it's easy to get lost in your thoughts, and it's very easy to say something you shouldn't say by accident. Yeah, you think maybe funny, but is not.
Right.
And we also try to encourage families, you know, not to make it, you know, too long, because it can get very monotonous for even the people, the mourners who are there. I always suggest somebody, maybe from a grandchild's perspective, from a child's perspective, from a friend's perspective, you get a very well-rounded picture of a person's life. And there are many other opportunities to exchange stories and other things and funny stories, you know, at Shiva or sometime afterwards. That's the opportunity for those type of things. So we see that a lot, many people speaking where people did not used to speak before.
And did you see differences in just the nature of the service itself? This idea of, and we were sharing some war stories before the show from both of our perspectives, you know, funny things and bizarre things that have happened all of both of our careers. But and I began to see this in California when I started my career and thought things were a little off the wall. And I remember one funeral director at Sinai Mortuary in Glendale.
I know who they are.
Yeah,
I know them.
We're saying, oh, that's nothing, right? You know, we had that last year, or we had that last week.
Right.
Have you gotten some very strange requests about what to do with the procession or the casket or?
Well, I wouldn't say as strange as opposed to different.
Okay, I mean, politically correct word.
Well, I'm in politics also, so I can't help it. I mean, if it's going to help the family get through a difficult time,
right,
there's nothing wrong with it, as long as it's really appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see a lot of people who place a lot of objects in the casket now, whether it be personal items. I've had people place a TV remote control in there because Dad always had the remote in his hand.
Cool.
I see people place, you know, pictures. Different items that meant something personal to the family. The personalization of funerals is probably the biggest change. It used to be, I wouldn't say cookie cutter, but mm-hmm. it was always expected, you know, this is how it happens, X, Y, Z in a row. But you find a lot more variations of that, and most of it is personalization. I find processions that maybe pass by a certain location, which is very much an old school type procession that really got lost for a couple of decades, and some people are starting to return to that again.
Have you seen this with generations? I mean, are you finding younger generations wanting it to be more adaptive, personalized, and more input from the family as opposed to just let the clergy person take care of it?
Exactly. More people have an idea, which is generally with society with all things these days,
right,
of what they want and how they want their thing to be. From weddings to bar mitzvahs to funerals, it's a matter of making it personal for them, how they always envisioned that their tribute would be, whether it be happy or sad. So they really tell the rabbi sometimes how they like it to be. The rabbi then gives them the guidance as far as the traditional aspects of the Kaddish, the Amalei Rachamim, the traditional prayers and things that are said, and can guide them through that way religiously. And they can make it more of the personal aspect by the speakers, by providing pictures in the lobby. We put up a TV monitor in our lobby 5 years ago, and we can play a slideshow. The person's life as people were standing in line waiting to say hi to the family and give them a hug and a kiss and having them take a seat. So I find that a lot of generational things, and I wouldn't even say maybe it is generational, but today, where do you define where today's generation is?
Right.
I think the people who are my age and maybe even – and not so much my parents' age, my age and your age are looking to do these things more personal, like every other life cycle event they're doing.
We're speaking with Harry Platt, the manager of Platt Memorial Chapel here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you on WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia and streaming live on www.wwdbam.com. And we're talking a lot about planning, and we want to bring you up to date again and remind you of a good friend of the show who also speaks about planning, and that's financial planning. And we're talking about the Hecht Investment Group of Johnny Montgomery Scott, which provides us concierge financial consulting and planning services. The Hecht Investment Group uses a formal investment process as their foundation, and as we've told you before, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. And as many of us know, there are no needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning. The Hecht Investment Group provides experience, guidance, and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. And additionally, Hecht and his team can assist you in connecting to the investment banking department, who specializes in assisting middle market companies achieve their strategic goals. So we invite you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll free at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. Or visit them at the HechtInvestmentGroup.com. And the Hecht Investment Group is also a member, is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and in Facebook. And Johnny Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and the SIPC. That's the Hecht Investment Group of Johnny Montgomery Scott. And again, toll free at 855-289-2168. Or HechtInvestmentGroup.com. We're back with Harry Platt, the manager of Platt Memorial Chapel in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, talking about some of the trends and laws and concerns that involve the current funeral industry. Harry, Platt Memorial Chapel does not only Jewish funerals, it's a memorial chapel open to all denominations, faith, cultures, etc. How different are the various concerns, traditions, rituals that you've been involved with various different cultures, especially as the cultural diversity of our community is changing so much?
Right, and then that's a big key. There's really no funeral home that can be to one particular group, although many are associated. We're associated with being a Jewish funeral home. We advertise ourselves as a Jewish funeral home as well. But we also are in the community that is very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm involved locally in my local government in Voorhees Township. I had served as mayor there for 5 years, and I'm currently deputy mayor. And at that time, I also serve as a liaison to the diversity committee, which means I have a lot of people calling us now with different groups and different faiths that never had called us before because of our personal connection that we have in the community. We're handling a lot of the Muslim community these days. And the biggest reason for that is because the Muslim community has grown, first of all. And secondly, there is no more similar burial traditions to Jewish community than the Muslim community. The services are very quick. It involves a ritual washing of the body done by a community organization. It involves going and certain prayers being said and the burial in the earth the same way that Judaism calls for. So more so where we are really involved with that community because we understand the speed that has to be done. We understand the customs and traditions. They're not foreign to us because they're so similar to Judaism as far as that's concerned. We also handle a lot of Hindu and Buddhist through the community that I live in and through the community that knows me through the diversity committee. A lot of their services wrap around a final result of cremation. But it always involves usually a service of some kind first.
Mm-hmm.
Even Jewish families who are doing cremation these days, and some Jewish families are, it is still contrary to Judaism, cremation. But some families are choosing that to do as their final form of disposition. 95% of the time, people are doing that involved with the service. One of the most important things when somebody passes away is to have the opportunity for your community to be able to come and help you and support you. And we often encourage people to try to have a service, whether it be at our chapel, whether it be at their home, just some sort of gathering as a final tribute and to allow people to come and help because it really helps families get through a difficult time when they have community support around them.
You mentioned cremation. And one of the shifts that I've seen in my career in the last 10 years is this real rise in interest in cremation. And I want to ask you about that. Why are you seeing this? Is it personal preference or the role of economics?
I think it's more personal preference than the role of economics. Sometimes it's definitely economics. And when a family comes to us and says we can only do the cremation this, we do whatever we can if they would prefer a traditional burial to provide a traditional burial for them, to be able to help them with finding graves where they wouldn't be required to purchase an outside burial container or burial vault, where the costs are low and we can help them do things as well. But a lot of times also it is a personal preference. It is a preference of the person who had just died. They always said I wanted to be cremated, so they do. And we will accommodate whatever families need, again, to help them get through this period of time.
Is there a standard cost now? Let's just say a family comes in. Is there a standard cost for a funeral without, you know, too much extra stuff?
An average cost for a funeral is around $8,500 approximately. And on top of that, the cemetery has costs. And the cemetery costs can vary from as little as $1,000 to up to $4,000, depending on the cemetery. So you can, even when you own the graves already, there's still costs to open the grave and dig the grave, things that we address when we talk about pre-planning, which we talked about earlier, and we'll get back to in a little bit. We address those things as well because there are a lot of other costs besides the funeral home costs that are involved with that. But an average cost for a funeral is around $8,500, and it's very dependent on the type of casket that is selected.
All right.
The average cost for an immediate or direct cremation is around $2,500. And that's also varies on a couple things like newspaper notices, death certificates, whether the family chooses to have an urn or not. An urn is not required for cremation, like a casket is not required for cremation, and embalming is not required for cremation. But these are things that can play a cost factor, and families will decide to include or not include based on what they prefer to do.
You do a lot of teaching. I know that.
Yes.
How important do you see it as your mission to really reach out to the community and bring school children in or adult classes in so that you demythologize and sort of like pull the curtain back from this is what happens, this is why it happens, this is where it happens?
That's probably the most important thing that this next the generation of my children and even to some point my generation, our generation, are going through, to teach them what happens, what decisions have to be made, and what the process is so key. Because often the first time I'm sitting down with someone who lost a spouse who's in their 80s, that's often the first time they're ever dealing with a funeral. Because the generation ago, their uncle took care of it, or their sister took care of it. Someone took care of it,
and
quote unquote shielded them from this horrible experience. It's not a good experience, obviously, but people need to be aware of what happens. So to take a group of confirmation students or an adult education class and take them through the funeral home, and we bring them into the building, we show them every single room. Chapel, the family room and office areas, the casket selection room, and the preparation area. We show them everything. We talk about what traditional burial is with Chevra Kadisha, the ritual community that comes in and does the washing and dressing, to something as not traditional as a metal casket and a mausoleum. So we talk about all different kinds of things. And the most important things I've always told people, and I find that make a Jewish funeral, a Jewish funeral, more than maybe a pine box or more than not being Jewish as a cremation, but the respect and dignity given to the family and the respect and dignity given to the deceased are the most important things that really differentiate a Jewish funeral in my book from other different religions.
Yeah, well, I can testify, you know, personally, because you are so brilliant with my mom that you guys do an unbelievable job especially around that area of caring for a family and dignity and respect brilliant. One of the concerns that I know you deal with all the time, because clergy deal with it in their congregations with families, is the long distance issue.
Yes.
You know, and not everybody dies, you know, within the confines of our community. And I'm sure that adds an additional stress to a family who may have to transport a body from Florida or from California or from, as we were talking before the show, overseas. How difficult is that? What instructions could you give a family who may be thinking about, well, maybe I better call up somebody and start thinking about this because dad or mom is living 1,000 miles away?
Right. It's something that happens more often than people think. especially with case with snowbirds in Florida, probably the biggest situation we have. But people, when they call us, and they had someone, I had this a few months ago, they passed away in California, and they were so flustered, what do we do, what do we do? I don't know anybody out there. I told them, we'll handle it. We have affiliates all over the country. There are actually now national companies that handle just this type of thing because people travel so much. Two generations ago, everyone lived in the same shtetl. You know, nobody went outside of the, moved outside of the gates. Mm-hmm. So everyone stayed together, and it was very easy to get the whole family together and get somebody back for burial. But today we have a system in place at our firm, as most firms do, that can easily bring someone back from any part of the country. And we just make the contacts we need to. The time frame may vary because some states you have a couple of different waiting periods. Florida is not bad. California, usually about 2 days. And that's due to their paperwork and their procedural things out there. Those things can't be avoided no matter how who you use or how you try. We just dealt with bringing someone back from overseas, from over in Europe. That took about a week and a half.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we worked with the State Department. We worked with the family. And we worked with – they had travel insurance from their credit card company. That was a phenomenal help to both the family and to us as far as trying to coordinate things. And it's just a matter of calling a professional that knows how to do it. And that's the biggest thing. You don't have to be alone in doing this. You can always reach out to someone to have them do this for you and help you through this. People who are aware of the process, the same way as you go to a doctor who knows about your condition, mm-hmm. because they're the ones who know, and a tax attorney, anyone you go to who knows their specific field, you can reach out to do that. And it does happen more than people think.
So before we run out of time, just one question that how does one become trained to do what you do? Get a degree from online.
Right, exactly.
Exams and there's training and there's walk us through real fast.
There's 2 years of an associate's degree you have mm-hmm. to have, and there's 1 year of a specialized mortuary school. The specialized mortuary school basically is training you to pass a national and state board. The real experience you get and what kind of funeral director you are really comes from your internship and where you work and how you learn how to treat people and do things. That's the biggest differing factor in all funeral homes is how people are treated. A lot of the things are very much the same. It's like going to buy a car, going to buy a house, how your realtor, how someone treats you is a lot different than the process itself, and that makes all the difference in the world. You take a state board, you take a national board, and then if you pass both state and national board, you receive a license. We have continuing ed credits we have to fill every 2 years. And based on you maintaining your license, you can continue to serve as a funeral director. I'm licensed in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. My son just started yesterday. My son Jacob.
Congratulations.
Third generation of funeral directors at the Platt family.
Wow.
And he'll be starting the process in college in 2 years.
Wow. That's very good.
Yeah, thank you.
So, that mazel tov on that, as we would say. We're again speaking with Harry Platt, the manager of the Platt Memorial Chapels in Cherry Hill. But before we end this segment, if you had this whole group of people sitting in front of you in, let's say, the Citizens Bank Park, and they just said, Mr. Platt, give us one good piece of advice for us to understand as we move forward. Working with you, what would it be?
Well, more people at the park than at the current Phillies games.
We won't go into that.
I would say to call us in advance and have some planning going on in your family. Talk to your family about what your thoughts are and needs, because oftentimes people sit there and say, "I have no idea what Dad or Mom wanted, mm-hmm. so I don't know what to do." Talk to your family. Talk to us. Get some things down on paper. Because one of the more difficult things also is when someone's at a time of loss, they're looking for a social security number. Mm-hmm. They're looking for a mother's maiden name back from the old country in Russia. So find out what is necessary for the process and do it at your own pace, but have some of these things in line. Let your family know what your thoughts are as well so people can be easier.
And if somebody wanted to contact you, how do they do that?
They can contact me. The best way is the telephone, believe it or not, right. These days, at Platt Memorial Chapels, 856-428-9442. And we're also at Platt Memorial at Comcast.net and www.plattmemorial.com.
Harry Platt, the manager of Platt Memorial Chapels in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Thank you very much. Lots of good information. Good luck with everything. Congratulations with your son.
Thank you.
And Really a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Great,
thank
great
you.
To be
thank
here.
You for
Thanks.
Coming over.
You're very
really
welcome.
Really appreciate it. You know, we continue to talk about lots of planning with Harry, and one of the other things that we talk about rarely is all this idea about pre-need and planning. And we ask you to think about this, and our friends at Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice also wanted to know, look, if surgery or an accident or a serious illness prevented you from speaking for yourself, would your loved ones know your wishes, and would you know theirs? Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice reminds us that now is the time to think, to talk, and to act. Think about what you'd want. If you couldn't speak, talk about your wishes with those who matter to you and act by writing them down. Experts agree that the right place to have these delicate conversations is around your kitchen table, not in crisis at the ICU. Think of these talks as your gift to your loved ones to communicate wishes, to prevent family burdens, and to avoid disagreements during times of crisis. And if you already have an advance directive, we invite you to find out today about taking the talk, this talk that goes far beyond the legal ramifications of living wills that you've developed with your lawyer, and really get involved with a program that Samaritan has called Timely Conversations. This is a program that you can access by going to SamaritanNJ.org. That's SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act. That accesses you to the Timely Conversations. Again, that's SamaritanNJ.org/think-talk-act. That's Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice in New Jersey. Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio, again being brought to you by the Kendall Corporation, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. And again, we remind you to join Kendall to help transform the experience of aging, and visit them, please, at this www.discoverkendall, that's with one L, .org. And again, the toll-free number is 888-759-0128. And thanks to Tony, I think we're ready to welcome Dr. Deborah Carr from Rutgers University. Dr. Carr, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for joining us on Boomer Generation Radio. How are things at Rutgers today?
They're very good, and I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, I'm very excited to talk about these series of studies and investigations you've done around caregiving. In the work that I do on Jewish sacred aging and going around the country, the number one issue that always comes up for our generation is the caregiving issue. So you've talked to me about this study that you've done.
Sure. Well, caregiving is an issue that faces all Americans. And by some estimates, there are as many as 44 million caregivers, which is about one in five Americans. But if you look at middle-aged people and older adults, it's almost a universal phenomenon where someone is called on to provide either physical care or emotional support or even bookkeeping assistance to a loved one, typically a parent or a spouse.
So the study that you did, how did it work? What did you do?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of ways to study caregiving. This one particular study we did was based on interviews with several thousand older adults, meaning those who were over age 65, and we had for them daily diary data, which means we knew every activity they had done in the prior week, and we looked to see what their emotional reactions were. And we looked to see specifically whether caregiving was linked with their emotional health and their physical health. And a lot of research previously had suggested that caregiving is distressing to the caregiver, but we actually found it was a bit more complex than that. We found that caregiving really requires two things. One is the actual physical care, delivering meals, helping people go to the bathroom. Those specific tasks were distressing to caregivers. It made them sad, it made them anxious, and in some cases it made them frustrated, meaning that they felt that they were working really hard, but they weren't achieving their goals. They didn't feel successful with those physical aspects of care. However, caregiving also involves emotional aspects of care. And for caregivers, especially female caregivers, they did derive some psychological benefits, specifically happiness, from knowing that they were enhancing the life of their loved one. And so the emotional aspects of care do tend to be more rewarding than the physical, which, as you know, can be quite grueling.
Well, I found in working with families also that it's sort of like an unexpected consequence, you just alluded to it, of even though this is difficult work and the caregiving life stage, and I really call it a new life stage, can last for a long, long, long time, there seems to be in some families, and you alluded to this, a moment when there's a positive sort of like reinforcement, almost an emotional, I don't know what the right technical term is, almost a spiritual connection that takes place in the process of caregiving, especially as you care for a parent, I think, more than anything else. Did you find that in your research and the studies?
Our study looks specifically at spouses, but the research does show what we call kind of the positive impact of caregiving. And I think it happens for a couple of reasons. One, in the case of parents, it's kind of this human need for reciprocity. You know, in life, it's nice to get things, but if we get more than we give, we sometimes feel guilty. And likewise, if we give more than we get, we feel resentful.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the place of caregiving for parents, oftentimes we recognize our parents have given a lot for us over our whole lives. They've given us food, shelter, support through every life transition. And caregiving back for our parents, especially when they're at their most vulnerable, is a way really to thank our parents and show gratitude for all the support that we've gotten from them over time. It's a way to connect to them. Often in adulthood, we don't spend as much time with our parents as we would like to, and caregiving brings you back together again. So it really can be beneficial for adult children. But I think there's one important caveat. As you know, right, given your expertise in aging, people don't really change that much over time. And there is one subgroup of people for whom parental caregiving is particularly distressing. And it's those individuals who have been mistreated by their parents earlier in life. So children who were subject to physical abuse, emotional abuse, kind of cold relationships with their parents. For them specifically, caregiving is not a time of reconnection, but actually a time when old negative feelings bubble up again.
Well, the resentment, and I would imagine in those cases, more so than perhaps, quote, normal, unquote, cases, the internalization of those feelings will produce sometimes physical ailments as well. Did you see that?
In that study in particular, we looked just at the emotional consequences, but we do know that stress in general takes a physical toll on our heart, our lungs, our immune system. And stress is worse for us when it is constant. And that's part of the reason why caregiving does take a physical toll. It's a rare person who gives care to their parent or aging spouse, you know, once a month. It tends to be pretty regular. And if that experience isn't bolstered by positive feelings and loving feelings, it really is this low-grade stressor that can erode one's health. And at the same time, it sometimes conjures up memories of bad times in one's past, some self-criticism, some self-loathing maybe if parents were particularly abusive. So in that very particular case, there can be a real physical and emotional toll of caregiving for a parent who was not always a wonderful parent.
Yeah. Now, your study, you mentioned, had a lot to do with spousal caregiving?
Yes, and that's one of my main areas of interest, spousal caregiving and also bereavement. And the two are kind of intertwined.
Oh, yeah.
Long-term caregiving, as you may know, is a relationship that often precedes grief and death. And so I do focus on spousal caregiving. And there are some clear gender differences here. Women do more caregiving, and you don't need an expert to tell you that. But there are a couple reasons why wives are much more likely to care for their husbands and vice versa. One is just plain demography. Men die younger. Men die 6 to 7 years younger on average than women. And on top of that, men tend to marry women who are about 3 years younger than themselves. So men tend to die first. So after they have died, women no longer have a husband to rely on for caregiving. Women tend to rely on their children, specifically their daughters, whereas men will rely on their wives. And that matters because the caregiving relationship many people see as just a continuation of the way marital relationships were earlier in life. And even in healthy couples, it tends to be the wife who does the health work and the care work, right? It's the wife who tends to remind the husband to take his medications and to go for a run and to eat the salad rather than the burger. And so those long-standing patterns of, you know, gendered relations, the way wives have control over their husband's health, is something that persists in the caregiving relationship as well.
Do you see any possibility of a shift in some of that as boomers age out, and there seems to be, as the baby boomers have gone through the generational process in these last several decades, a greater attempt at equality of sharing responsibilities? So do you think baby boomer men, as they age, are going to be involved more in caregiving?
Absolutely. And I think the change is going to be slow. It's not going to be quite 50-50. But we definitely see that happening for a couple of reasons. For current generations of older adults, you know, those in their 70s and 80s, the wives typically stayed home with their children. And they were caregivers, whereas the husbands were at work for pay. Among the baby boomers, women were in the paid workforce. So they actually have skills that allow them to be really independent later in life. But at the same time, that required the men to do more caregiving. So the generations of men and women both are adept at financial management skills, but they're also increasingly adept at the caregiving. And also there's a cultural shift as well. You know, 50 years ago, a man who was a house husband would be looked at kind of as a funny character, whereas today men actually get a lot of shout out and respect from the community for being a caregiver. So there's an incentive to actually develop these caregiving skills and meal production skills. It's something that makes a man look like a well-rounded man rather than someone who isn't living up to our traditional ideals of masculinity.
So real men are caregivers.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's good to hear.
You know, and it goes very much appreciated. I think sometimes women are afraid to ask for kind of caregiving help because they feel guilty.
That's
and
true.
And so I think men should absolutely feel free to step up and offer the care that the wives might not ask for.
We're speaking with Deborah Carr, professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at Rutgers University up in New Brunswick and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Gerontology and Social Sciences. And we'll be right back with Dr. Carr on Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 right after this message.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. a system of not-for-profit communities and services that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Kendall is committed to working with others as we together transform the experience of aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Back again here on Boomer Generation Radio, WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley, streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And a reminder, you can contact the show, Boomer Generation Radio at gmail.com, and like us on the Boomer Generation Radio page on Facebook. We're back with Dr. Deborah Carr, professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at Rutgers University and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Gerontology Social Sciences. Dr. Carr, you were talking about the whole spousal caregiving phenomenon and bereavement following that. And your research, did you find people who are involved in long-term caregiving with a spouse? And I'm really thinking now of this explosion of caregiving with Alzheimer's and dementia, who really start the grieving process way before the actual death occurs.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For people with long-term chronic illness, there is something called anticipatory grief, which means you start to grieve before the actual death. And I think that's important for caregivers to think about. Death is not really an event. It's a process. It's a process of dying. And one is dying, their body starts to fail. And in many cases, caregiving for someone who's physically frail but who's mentally intact can be rewarding for some of the reasons we talked about earlier. You're bolstering them. You're helping them. Caregiving for a loved one with dementia poses really unique challenges because you can absolutely derive a sense of meaning of knowing you're supporting this loved one during their most difficult hour. But the person's self often isn't there anymore. Those traits that you loved about your loved one, the conversational style, the sense of humor, all of those aspects may still be with the individual, but they might not be apparent to the caregiver. Those conversations aren't happening. The exchanges of gratitude aren't happening. So giving care for a dementia or Alzheimer's patient can be very, very difficult. And one thing that we do see is that one's level of grieving or how sad and despondent you are after the death of a spouse varies very widely based on how they die. If it's a sudden death, the grief is very acute. But if the death happens after a long-term caregiving spell, the greatest number of symptoms of depression happen before the death. It happens when you're watching this individual suffer. And actually, after they die, the bereaved person feels a sense of relief really more than anything else, relief in knowing that their loved one's suffering has stopped. And I think older adults or caregivers don't need to feel guilty if they're not devastated upon the death of a loved one because they've paid their dues and they've done their grieving as they watch their loved one suffer and slip away. Once the death happens, the loved one is out of their suffering, and I think that's something important for caregivers to acknowledge.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot of families. It's sort of like in the cultural counterintuitive that you're expecting after the death this massive outpouring of grief, and yet I've seen in these long-term caregiving situations where a family, there is no massive outpouring of grief. There is a almost like a gentle passage, acceptance, and in a way a celebration that this tragedy or this suffering is ended and we can now celebrate this life, and it obviously is quite personal. One of the issues that I wanted to ask you too, if you and how your research in the caregiving looked at the impact of caregiving on the total family system, because this is not just one person caring for another person. Usually there's a family involved. And what did your research find, if anything, on the impact of caregiving to the entire family system, children, grandchildren, et cetera?
Sure, that's a great question. I have studied, again, the impact of caregiving on families, the ways that end-of-life preparations affect families, because preparing for end-of-life, as you discussed earlier, I view as something that's linked to caregiving. It's helping to ensure a high-quality death. Families, one important point is that families don't change that much over time. It's pretty rare that caregiving is going to change what a family is. What it will do is amplify what a family has always been. And I think that's an important point, that those families that have always been cooperative, collegial, open in their communication, they often fare the best during the caregiving process. They learn how to negotiate the distribution of tasks. They figure out a way to be fair. They figure out a way to show gratitude, especially if there's one sibling, for instance, who has most of the caregiving responsibilities, often because they live closest. A well-functioning family will figure out ways to reward or thank that person. Even as coarse as it sounds, making sure that the primary caregiver maybe gets a larger chunk of the inheritance, for instance. So I think functional families will try very hard to maintain and restore equity, and that cannot be understated, that people need to feel that everybody is giving equally and receiving equally in the caregiving relationship. If one feels they're carrying the whole burden, that can be really problematic. So that's an important point. Strong families do well, but for problematic families, long lingering resentments come out in caregiving.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as parents say they love all their children equally, there are heaps of data showing that parents have favorites. And they have a favorite child for different things. They have a child who's a better caregiver. They have a child who's a better fun friend, for instance. Children know that, and sometimes those feelings of favoritism or being the low child on the totem pole often reemerge when the caregiving happens, and then certainly after the death happens. So the families that have been problematic really need to communicate with each other, and they need to, at some level, move beyond the past and let some of those old resentments go, because if they don't, it's going to be a very long haul through caregiving, and it will compromise those sibling and parent-child relationships after the death happens.
Yeah, and every clergy person will give you chapter and verse of having worked with families where all those dynamics come out. And the old, you know, the adage that you're alluding to, that people age and die as the family lived, as they lived, really is true, and it's sad sometimes to really see that at a moment when there should be this coming together, there's this still, you've always done it this way, or, you know, you never, dad never liked me, or mom always treated you better, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about, in the research, you know, about the loneliness factor, about the spouse who's caregiving, and he or she is really on the front lines, and faces so many moments and hours of being on their own, alone. And what impact does that have on the whole system?
Absolutely. Caregiving can be a very lonely experience. And in some of my research, I show that caregiving, even if, again, bolsters your mood, those who do really intensive caregiving may be more likely to have health problems, specifically heart problems or even premature death after the caregiving ends and after they've been bereaved. And part of the reason is what you just mentioned is the loneliness. And then another reason has to do with how we view health in this world. So caregiving can be a very lonely experience. And I found actually particularly for men who are caregiving, they often don't reach out to people outside of the family. Maybe they won't reach out to their children, either because they're not comfortable asking for help or because alternatively they feel, this is what I must do. I must be autonomous and bear this burden on my own. But what it often means is that they're not taking good care of themselves. And you've seen studies in the paper all the time that show after a wife dies, the husband dies the next day, for instance. And often it seems like a very romantic tale of dying of a broken heart. But that's not actually the case. The issue is that the husband or the wife often has not been taking good care of themselves because they've been so focused on the spouse and they haven't been reaching out for or looking for social support to help them. And so it really is important that caregivers rely on their loved ones, even use an adult daycare center where maybe they can drop off their loved one who requires care so they can engage in self-care. And self-care is not selfish. Self-care is a way to sustain oneself, to continue to be a caregiver, and to maximize one's ability to care well. And that cannot be understated. One thing I often find in research is that caregivers ignore their own symptoms. And this may be something you've seen with the families you work with. If you're a caregiver and you're caring for someone with dementia or someone with cancer, you might say, oh, I had a little chest pain, it's nothing important. Oh, my back hurts, it's nothing important, because it's nowhere near as bad as what my dementia-afflicted husband is going through.
Right.
But in minimizing symptoms, you neglect them. They fester, they may develop into something more full-blown, and again, that's yet another factor that contributes why sometimes spouses die very close in time. Again, it's not the romance of the broken heart, it's neglecting one's symptoms and not being treated because we don't think our own symptoms are important. So this notion of self-care and reaching out really can't be stated strongly enough to those who are giving care currently.
I just was having this conversation with a family last week, mm-hmm. and walked out side with the spouse and reminded them to please make sure that they get rest, make sure that they get exercise, and eat properly and have proper nutrition, because it's the opposite, as your research and is showing and many people have experienced. It's quite easy not to do those things because they need me. I can't have respite care. I can't go out for lunch with my friends because God forbid something happens. And yet, as your research is showing, you need to, because you have to be available at your height or your peak. And those physical and emotional issues are very, very powerful. Before we run out of time, we have about 2 minutes left. One real thing. How important is the spiritual component in caregiving?
I think it's important for those who value spirituality and religion. If someone's never been oriented toward that, it may not particularly help. But for those who are believers in some higher force, it is absolutely helpful. Sometimes our everyday kind of bodily concerns overwhelm us, and we need to step back and look at larger concerns. And especially for patients who are dying, having spiritual thoughts and attention to spiritual issues actually helps them to go more peacefully into the transition to death. If they can make peace with what they have, they feel they have a good sense of values, that's something that can absolutely help them and their caregiver to make sense of the process. Death is very hard to understand. We challenge it. We question why. And turning to our spiritual views, whatever they are, sometimes to help may help the transition to seem more natural and just and expected.
Dr. Carr, I have to ask you this question because you've done all this research, you write, you edit. Is it time for society to really sponsor in colleges, universities, community centers, religious organizations, a real organized class in caregiving?
I think that would be wonderful, because even those of us like me, who's a medical sociologist who studies death, can't always figure it out. There are very hard things to negotiate. If you're taking care of hospice at home and you have difficult medical regimens to do, if you don't know how to organize, you know, health insurance, just recognizing what you know and having lessons that teach practical things as well as lessons that teach the importance of self-care, then cannot be understated. If you revisit my initial point, 44 million caregivers, there are very few other experiences in life that are so universal for which there is no formal training. And so every single one of us will be there, and whatever we can do to support and educate people is essential.
And not everybody has the time or perhaps the desire to sit down and go to Barnes & Noble and read one of the millions of books on how to care for your aging parents or how to care for anyone, correct?
Exactly, because self-help at some level carries a message of deficiency, right? We need self-help because we can't do it on our own. It's not a deficiency at all. It's a natural inevitability. And if we really spin this as something that everyone's grappling with, we're all in the same boat, let's all learn together, I think that would be very effective. People need to feel that they're competent in what they're doing and need to feel that they're not alone, that they can reach out should they need the help.
Dr. Deborah Carr, Professor and Chair of Department of Sociology at Rutgers University, thank you very much for teaching us a lot more about the art of caregiving, as I call it, and all your research. Thank you very much for being with us here on Boomer Generation Radio. To all of you, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next week, Tuesday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern. Have a great week, everyone. Stay healthy. Thank you, Dr. Carr.
Thank you. I hope this was helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.